Just while we're waiting for the last people to come in, because today's talk will be a bit shorter, because I wish to rush off to our temple in Olamara for the rites and rituals. But it's also the Easter retreat, and somebody gave me a nice Easter joke. What do you get when you pour hot water down a rabbit hole? Hot cross bunnies. Well, it's a topical joke. Okay, those people who come a bit late, I think they've avoided a bad joke. But for this morning's talk, more serious, well, not really that serious, but just on the development of mindfulness during this retreat, and sometimes that it's a huge subject these days, but very few people explain about the different types of mindfulness, how to focus the mindfulness on this or that, how to choose the objects of mindfulness, and also a few other little things. And the most important one is how to develop mindfulness. You can't just say, I will be mindful, and order it like you can turn a switch. Instead, you have to understand the causes for mindfulness and how they grow and grow and grow. And surprise, surprise, one of the great causes of mindfulness is stillness. Because if you do so much, think too much, have too much business, you'll find your mindfulness gets less and less and less. It gets weaker and weaker and weaker, simply because the mind is tired, it's exhausted. So, you will find on this retreat, the less you do, the more you become aware. And for those of you who haven't heard me explain this before, it's a very important and powerful understanding of the nature of the mind, which is its two parts. The two parts of the human mind are the knower and the doer. And if you want to know this in Pali, that's the vijnana and the sankhara, basically. And the doer always gets first pick of the energy available to the mind. So we're always doing something. And you can see just in your own life how hard it is to come to a place like this where you don't have to do anything. Yeah, you have a few chores, you know, in the kitchen, but that's nothing. Hardly anything. And so you have all these days with nothing to do. And what happens is people make something for themselves to do. Sometimes people at the end of a retreat, sometimes they think, oh, can I do some gardening? Can I do some weeding? What they're really saying is that I'm restless. I want to do something. So little by little, on this retreat, we try and encourage people to do less and less and less. And the less you do, the more energy is available for your knowing. But of course, people may not be doing much physically, but they're still doing so many things between their ears. Thinking, planning, writing their autobiography, wanting to do an article about 9-day Easter retreat at Jhana Grove for the newsletter, always doing something. Where is he? Selling books. Sometimes we always want to do something. But that is restricted here. And because it's restricted, you'll find that mental energy, which usually gets wasted in doing so much, now can flow into knowing. It's available for your mindfulness. Basically, that your senses get shined up and brightened up. You can hear the sound of the birds in the morning because you're not thinking and wasting your energy. The food begins to taste more delicious. I know many people at the end of the retreat, they always compliment the delicious food in this retreat center. And it has nothing to do with the cooks. I'm sorry, Bianca, but it's not your fault. It's everything to do with the fact that your mindfulness is increasing. And you can, your taste buds get more sensitive. I first discovered that. The very first meditation retreat I went to was in 1971, I think. Just a group of students. We got a group of boarding houses in Bateman Street. Did you go on that one? No, later on.
A few years later,
okay, yeah. And this was student boarding houses. I was really looking forward to going on the retreat, but the one thing I was not looking forward to was the food. I even contemplated bringing sandwiches. Because, number one, in those days, England was not noted for its culinary expertise. In fact, everything usually tasted the same. No matter what vegetable it was, it always tasted the same. Because everything, every bit of taste was boiled out of it. So, it wasn't looking, and that was just ordinary food. But in boarding houses for poor students, that was where they employed cooks who couldn't get a job anywhere else. That was the lowest of the low when it comes to chefs. So thinking about that, I thought, this is going to be a very hard time. But I was so surprised, pleasantly surprised, that the food tasted delicious. And at the time, I thought it was my good karma. A very lucky monk, a student at the time, of all the boarding house cooks in the whole of that country, I managed to strike lucky and get one who could actually cook. But of course, I soon realized that was not the case. The reason why my food tasted delicious was because I wasn't doing much. I really even then knew how to let go and be peaceful and not to think so much, which meant all the energy of my mind had gone into mindfulness. I became so alert, so awake, that whatever remnant of flavor was left after all that boiling, I could pick up. That was why it tasted delicious, because my tongue had increased in its sensitivity. That is mindfulness. And you will find that on this retreat. You will have the indicators that your mindfulness is increasing when the food becomes even more delicious. When, like I was doing this morning, look at the clouds, and the clouds are amazing. When you can look at the grass around the stupas, and the grass is incredible. That every one of your senses wakes up and becomes much more alive because you are not reacting, you are just knowing. Your mindfulness is increasing. And that is like a free gift in the cereal packet for you. That you're doing mindfulness not to so much enjoy yourself, but to get some understanding of the Dhamma. But the more you wake up, the more life looks beautiful. The more food tastes more delicious. Now, of course, I've been practicing this for so many years. So you can imagine when I'm on retreat, how much my mindfulness increases. So how much the food tastes more delicious. And how much, because it's so delicious, I eat more than I should. And this is one of the problems with mindfulness. I've got all these excuses for putting on weight. I'll say a few more later on. But anyway, now that's true. When you get really mindful, you get awake. And the opposite of that is that when you do so much and think so much, your mindfulness gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So you can't see anything beautiful anymore. Which is one of the reasons people get depressed, why they get angry, why they get grumpy, why they get fault-finding. Because low energy. Why people get depressed. That's really low energy. So, as you do less, become more still, think less, plan less, and remember less, you become much more aware. You are waking up, which is the word the Buddha. The Buddha is a Pali word which comes from the verb bujjati, and bujjati is to wake up. So the Buddha is called the awakened one. But you've been in here early in the morning, you've been here late at night. Have you seen the Buddha falling asleep? Of course not. He's woken up. So he just sits there, does nothing. A symbol of great mindfulness, doing nothing. So you'll find, as an indicator of how this retreat is going, the more aware you become, the more you notice the sky or the moon at night time, the more you can hear the sounds in the forest, the more you become sensitive to the wind. And instead of thinking it's cold, I'm going to hide away from this, you think, wow, this is just so much going on in just a gust of wind. Feel it over all of your pores of your skin. You become so alive and it becomes incredibly pleasant. That's why depression is a suffering state. Being awake, being alive is very, very pleasant and happy. So you find out that as the mindfulness grows, because of stillness, it's not just physical stillness, it's a mental stillness as well, you will start to understand that you're getting not just more aware, but more happy and more joyful. It's easier to smile when you wake up. I know that some people tell me that when they first wake up in the morning, they are like a monster. We call these the yakkas. Many men are like yakkas in the morning until they've had their first cup of coffee. And then, women too as well, don't talk to your wife until she's had a strong cup of tea or coffee in the morning. And afterwards, they're human beings again. It's like the lower realms, we raise up because we've got a bit more energy, and which means we're more happy. You can understand what I mean. Now, that's only a metaphor, but when you really start to wake up in your mind, the mindfulness gets stronger, what you see is just so much more beautiful. And I cannot resist the old metaphor of walking up Kingsbury Drive. After 7 years of living in the monastery over the road, which many of you, if not all of you, have visited, one morning I asked, can I get out of the car? I want to walk up the hill. And you wouldn't believe how difficult that is for me to do. Not to walk up the hill, but to get out of the car. Because no one lets me. So no, I jump on. Even here, I can't even open a door for myself. People say, I'll open it for you. So it's very hard for Mike to get exercise, but I manage, when you're not looking. And And so this day, it's a beautiful morning, plenty of time. Let's have a nice, not sort of conquering that hill and seeing how fast I can go up there, not trying to beat my personal best. We're not into that. We're into personal worsts, not personal bests. Actually, no person at all. That's why they have this another Buddhist joke for you, is they have over in the dining room, is it self-service these days? Like a buffet? Later on, when some of you get some enlightenment experiences, you'll find there'll be two sets of tables. One is self-service, and the other one, for the people who are enlightened here, is no self-service. The two different lights. How can you have self-service when there's no self? Anyway, I try my best to cheer you up. So I went on a walk up the hill, and it was an amazing experience, simply because when I walked up that hill, and I'd been living up there at the time 7 years, when I walked up the hill, I could not recognize it. It looked totally, 100% different than what I remembered when I looked at that hillside through the window of a moving car. And it was so strange. I was, where am I? Is this the Kingsbury Drive, the hill on the top of which I live? And I stopped and stared, in confusion, I must say. And then, as I stopped and stared, the hillside changed again. When I stopped, I saw things I'd never, ever seen before, never imagined were in that hillside. And also, it all looked so incredibly beautiful. More beautiful than I could ever seen before. I never remember the hillside so attractive. Just all the colors were just gorgeous. Greens and browns and the little stream in the bottom of the valley. And it really shook me. Why is this happening? And of course, the first thing I thought, that maybe at the breakfast somebody had put some magic mushrooms in the mushroom soup or something, I don't know. But actually that happened once in our monastery in Thailand. After our one meal of the day, one of the villagers rushed in. They're running in. He said, are you all okay? I said, yeah, well, we think so. Why? He said, well, one of the villagers, they put the wrong type of mushroom in the curry that morning. It was one of those hallucinogenic mushrooms. And being monks from the 60s, we're all really disappointed that no one took any of that. 60s monks, okay. But anyway, of course we don't do anything like that, so that was ticked off. That can't be what's happening. But then, of course, I just used reason. And our answer was really obvious. When you look through the window of a moving car, when the light reaches the back of your eye, the retina, there is a chemical reaction, and that causes the electrical impulses to go through your optic cord into your brain. Trouble is, when you look through the window of a car, the chemical reaction in the back of the eye doesn't have chance to fully complete, for another image comes up. Moves out the first one, and another image, and another image, and another image, and another image. For those of you my age who've ever developed photographs, I remember doing that in the science labs. You get a photograph, not the digital cameras, the old analog cameras a long time ago. You put it in the developing liquid, and it takes a while. The image suddenly appears slowly, and the longer it's in that chemical solution, the image actually emerges with more detail, and the colors are more fully formed. That's what happens in the back of your eye. And so what happens is, when you're looking through the car, it doesn't fully complete the image. So you miss out so much. More importantly, the colors aren't fully formed either. The greens aren't, they're like pastel. They haven't had a chance to fully form. When you get out of the car, and you walk, because you're going slower, the images are more complete. So you see more detail and the colors are richer. But when you stand perfectly still and look at that hillside, wow, now the image is complete and your mind, your brain, you might say, has more chance to explore all the incredible detail which was always in that image, but which you were going too fast to really see. And that's why the colors were now fully green, fully yellow, fully blue, fully brown. They had not been washed out anymore. And that became a wonderful simile for me, why when we live our life doing stuff, which means we're rushing around, we're like looking through the window of a speeding car, and that car is us. Of course, we miss so many details. We're not mindful. We may think we are. We only see a fraction of what's out there. But the more we slow down, not just physically, but mentally, when we get to some state of stillness, wow, now you can start to see the detail. And now everything starts to look beautiful. So this is what mindfulness actually gives you. Now there's another thing about mindfulness. I gave a talk in Singapore recently about mindfulness and dementia. Because I'm a bit concerned sometimes the way I teach, because I'm encouraging people to let go of the past. To not plan for the future. And to socially disengage. And those are three signs of dementia. That's what dementia is. You can't remember who you are. Oh, that's a fourth sign. Non-self. You don't own anything because you've got no past. You're not worried about the future. And you socially disengage. Oh, my goodness. What am I doing? But when I gave that talk, I also made the point that in Pali, in the old Buddhist language, mindfulness, sati, is the same word for memory. They use the same word. Mindfulness, memory. And of course, then that starts to lead in to the fact that even in neuroscience, when you do an act mindfully, when you listen mindfully, you remember it. It makes a neural connection, the more aware you are. And I've used this, again, this is on a tangent here, but it's important for you, programming your mindfulness. Many of you, I've given this little technique many times, and the reason it works is because mindfulness and memory are linked together. This is so wide. I mean, if you do lots of mindfulness, it hasn't really been investigated, but I'm pretty sure you'll find that the incidence of dementia just plummets. You don't get dementia when you practice mindfulness, because it increases your memory. But in particular, programming your mindfulness, you may all have little difficulties, maybe not sleeping well at night, having bad or difficult dreams. So what you do, you tuck yourself in bed, you get yourself comfortable, and then you say to yourself, I will have a peaceful night's sleep, I will have a peaceful night's sleep, I will have a peaceful night's sleep. You're programming your mindfulness. But you have to say that clearly. You know what it's like when people ask you, can you do something for me? You've got to have clear instructions, first of all. If the instructions aren't clear, you get in all sorts of trouble. Just like, you know, I'm going to be rushing off in another 20 minutes. So the driver's in the back there. I have to give the driver clear instructions. Not like the nun in England. This famous nun in England, she was in the passenger seat, had a driver, and because monks and nuns aren't allowed to drive, and she was giving directions. And they came across a junction, and the nun said, "Go straight ahead at the roundabout." And the driver did. She never went round the roundabout. She went straight ahead, right in the middle, over the hump in the middle, and down the other side. "Well, that's what you told me to do." It actually happened. So, I have to be very careful. Just go round the roundabout. Go straight ahead at the lights once they're green. But if you're programming mindfulness, you have to be very precise what you want your mind to do. Listen really carefully. In other words, be as mindful as you can. And if you are fully mindful, or at least 90% mindful, really aware, listening, paying attention to what you're programming, then it's amazing how it works. You have a peaceful night's sleep. And if you haven't tried this yet, many of you have, is to, I don't know what time you want to get up tomorrow morning. For those of you who haven't actually experienced the amazing, a wonderful, incredible experience of morning chanting at 6 o'clock. What are you laughing for? Well, okay, it's a bit over exaggeration, but if you want to try it out, but you can never get up in time, tonight when you go to bed, you program your mindfulness. I will wake up at 5:45. I will wake up at 5:45. I will wake up at 5:45. Listen to what you're saying. Pay attention. And then go to sleep. And it's incredible. At least for me, it works every time. You know, I don't even need to set the alarm clock and wake up. I haven't got a clue what time it is. And it's usually 1 or 2 minutes either side of 5:45. Amazing. You don't have to worry. You program your mindfulness. You have to be very aware when you're doing this, and the body and the mind actually follow. And I've used that a lot when people have any difficulties or problems in meditation. Say, like one person, say they see the lights and they get excited. So how can I stop that? You program your mindfulness. You begin meditation, you get yourself nice and comfortable, and you say to yourself, "When I see those lights, I will not get excited." And you really pay attention. Do it slowly, usually 3 times. "When I see those lights, I will not get excited. When I see those lights, I will not get excited." And then you leave it alone. Your mind remembers the instructions. You don't have to keep reminding yourself, "I must not get excited, okay? I mustn't get excited." Remember, don't get excited. Watching your breath, and remember, don't get excited. That's so disturbing. Just say it once, listen, and it's in there. And it's wonderful, actually, to see it working. You know, you actually see some lights, you're about to get excited, but something stops it. Your program starts to kick in. So that's actually how we use mindfulness to program mindfulness. And in daily life, I don't know why this is, the old joke is, you know, when you're in relationships, in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of you because you're arguing so loud. And you see that, and this couple, they're both really, really nice people. But you get in these bad habits of talking to each other and always picking out faults and saying nasty words to each other. It gets a habit which, you know, destroys a relationship. And how do you stop it? Program your mindfulness. When I speak to my husband, I will always say something nice, pleasant. When I speak to my husband, I will say something nice, pleasant. When I speak to my husband, I'll say something nice, pleasant. It doesn't have to be your husband. It can be your mother. It can be your mother-in-law. It can be somebody else. But you actually change the habits by programming your mindfulness. So this is where mindfulness and memory come together. So all those things, even which I teach, if you really pay attention, it's amazing just how you do get brainwashed. That's how Ajahn Chah taught me. Many, many, many great similes, great teachings, which at the time I could not understand. But I listened, and it was just amazing. I was awestruck sometimes, years later, after he passed away. I'd be meditating, come across a little problem in meditation, and straight away, you have the answer. And I recognize, yeah, Ajahn Chah told me that years ago, and I hadn't thought about it for years, 20 years or something. And it came up. Because when he was teaching, I was paying attention. My mindfulness was programmed by him. And the wonderful effect it had on me. So this is actually how your mindfulness works. It's not just being aware, it's also memory. And you know the mindfulness is being generated and getting stronger because you do get more awake, more alive, more happy. And it does come sometimes on this retreat, it will happen to a few of you, you get so awake, so aware, so joyful that you can't sleep at night. And you don't have to sleep. For those of you worried, you will always catch up on your sleep when you're in your box called your coffin. Then you can sleep as much as you like. But what happens sometimes, you get so still. Your brain is just basically idling. It doesn't need much energy. So the purpose of sleep, you know, just to give your brain a bit of a rest, is not needed anymore. But nevertheless, your body needs to rest. So what you do, if ever you get really, really awake in this meditation, you can sit, you can walk, but then comes a time you just go to your room and just lay down. And just don't try to go to sleep, just be aware and enjoy the moment. Where people lose it is when they start to go off into the future and they start to worry. What will happen if I don't go to sleep? I've heard if you don't go to sleep, being sleep deprived, you go mad, you go crazy. You get all these neurological disorders. Maybe my brain will blow up. Maybe when I come out of the retreat, they'll send me to the funny farm. Maybe. That has never happened. I've been teaching meditation for so many years, and there has never been one person who's gone crazy after my retreat. Not one. There hasn't been anybody who's died on my retreats. Not one. I've got 100% perfect track record. So, you are not going to be the first to go crazy. Become peaceful, become happy, become enlightened maybe, but not crazy. So you are safe. So just be in the present moment, enjoy this moment. If the body needs to sleep, it will sleep. If it wants to stay awake, it stays awake. I'm not owning my body, I'm just visiting it. So I just allow the body just to do its thing. And little by little, you'll find you become more awake, more energized. And it's wonderful being energized, even without a cup of coffee. It's even better without one. You just wake up in the morning and alive, alert, happy, smiley, simply because your mindfulness is becoming strong. And the purpose of that mindfulness now is that because it's stronger, it can see more detail. So when you close your eyes and start meditating, some of those old habits which you thought were just natural, you can find, hang on, there's something I can do about this, or rather I can let go of. And a good example of that is the wandering mind. I've already mentioned to you, don't stop the wandering mind by using willpower. I tried that years ago. The way I was taught If your mind wanders off, grab hold of it and bring it back. And it wanders off again, bring it back. And it wanders off again, bring it back. And it wanders off again, bring it back. For years it was wandering off and I was bringing it back. It never stayed home. It doesn't work. So using willpower didn't really make any sense. But when you got a little bit more mindful, you saw what was happening. You find out the cause of the wandering mind. Why is my mind wandering away? Because it didn't like me, that's why. We had a very bad relationship, my mind and I. I tried to control it. It was my slave. If you treat anyone like a slave, telling them what to do, they will run away from you. My old simile, which again I tell many times. You get a phone call. Not in the retreat, you're not supposed to have your telephone, your mobile phones on. So you get a telephone call one afternoon, and it's from an acquaintance of yours, and say, do you want to come out for a cup of coffee? You say, okay. And they said, you're going to come to my coffee shop, Gloria Jean's. I like Gloria Jean's. I know you don't like it, but I like it, so you're coming there. And you're going to have a short black, because that's what I like. And you're going to have a biscuit, because I like the biscuits, none of your muffins. And we're going to sit in the back where I like to sit, and we're going to talk about important stuff like politics, because that is how the world is run. None of your spiritual mumbo-jumbo. And we're going to be there for an hour, because that's all the time I have. Now, if any... it's only a simile. If anybody like that called you up, telling you where to go, what to drink, what to eat, where to sit, for how long, or what to talk about, would you love to go and spend time with a control freak like that? And of course not. You make up any excuse. Oh, I just forgot. Dentist appointment. Maybe next time. And to keep your precepts, as soon as she's off the phone, you ring up your dentist and make an emergency appointment. And after making the emergency appointment, then another friend gives you a call. How are you feeling this afternoon? Oh, just I made a dentist appointment. Oh, that's such a shame. Because you keep telling me of this little coffee shop, which hardly anybody knows about. And you say the lattes there are to die for. They're just so delicious. And the chocolate chip muffins, oh, that they're just like heavenly food. And you've always wanted to tell me about this Buddhism and meditation. I'm actually interested. And then what would you say? You'd say, okay, see you in half an hour. I'm cancelling the dentist appointment. To be with a friend who wants to go where you want to go for a cup of coffee, to drink your favorite type of coffee, just to find out. They respect you. Eat what you like to eat. And talk about what's really, really fascinating for you. And of course you want to go. And you end up spending all afternoon there enjoying yourself. Time just flies past. Now that's a simile for meditation. Some of you say, right, we're going to watch the breath now. Breath meditation. I know you want to do something else. You're going to sit here, not where you like to sit, on a chair. You're going to sit on a floor for a change. Meditate properly. No teddy bears. Nope. I don't like teddy bears. We're serious meditators. Sit down and we're going to meditate there for an hour. Not 45 minutes. I don't care if you're in pain. 1 hour. You sit there no longer and you're going to watch the breath. Of course, you know, I've done that before. Of course, my mind runs away from me. Anything to get away from control freak. But instead, if you sit down and say, mind, do you want to meditate? And you can sit on a chair if you like. You can lean back if you want to lean back. You know, quarter of an hour, half an hour, 5 minutes, however long you want. What do you want to do? Want a breath meditation, scanning the body meditation, just letting be meditation? What do you want to do, mind? And if you treat the mind like that, it will not run away from you. It likes you. and you spend hours sitting on the same seat or cushion, time flies when you're enjoying yourself with your best friend. So, my mind and I, we've made up. Every time it falls asleep, I don't criticize it. Oh, poor mind, you must be tired. Have a good nap. When it's restless, I don't say, oh, stop it, mind. I say, oh, if that's what you want to do, off you go. When you're finished, come back. I don't get indulged in it, like I was saying. Don't allow it to go for a joyride. Stand back a bit. But whatever you want to do, I just watch you. And then you find, with a good attitude, loving kindness, your mind doesn't want to run away. It stays with you. That's what mindfulness does. It sees the causes. There's another thing which the mindfulness sees, is I always thought that I'm meditating, watching my breath, getting nice and peaceful, then these thoughts come in. And I thought these are called stray thoughts. They come in by themselves. But when your mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, when you start to see what's actually happening, what you actually see is that you go searching for thoughts. And you bring one in. Why? Because you're bored. Stray thoughts don't come in without you inviting them. You go looking for them. There's one over there and you bring it in. A lot of times you're not mindful enough to see that process. But once the mindfulness grows, well, it's so obvious. Just because of lack of contentment, otherwise known as boredom. Which is one of the reasons why it's important to cultivate the happiness. The happiness comes by itself. Stillness, strong mindfulness, everything looks beautiful. You're so happy. Food is delicious. Even the cold is just so invigorating. The warmth. Oh, I can take this. Everything. Even the same old jokes become funnier. It's just mindfulness. Everything looks more beautiful. You can see more nuances in them. Well, look, if boarding house food in England can taste delicious, my bad jokes can be just so funny. This is actually what happens. But when you get that mindfulness gets really, really strong, you can actually see what goes on. The mindfulness allows you to overcome the more subtle hindrances. Discontent. So you can develop you realize the importance of joy and happiness. It's not something which is a hindrance to meditation and to be got rid of, to be ignored. Any little bit of happiness and joy, you indulge in. You encourage, you develop, you bring up, allow it to be. So if you feel like laughing during the meditation, please go for it. Laugh. It'll make everybody else happy as well. Anything, just like the walking meditation. The nuns are getting scared now. Okay, who did it last time? Because there's many different ways of doing walking meditation. It's not just starting at the beginning and going to the end, turning around, going back again. When Buddhism comes to each different land, we have to adapt to the culture. And Natalie, you did a wonderful one last time. Yeah, come on. So we have developed Australian walking meditation, which will now be demonstrated by... Come on, Natalie, you did it. Such a good job last time. This is Australian walking meditation. If you get depressed, if you get tired, you want to have a boost of energy, in the room over there and do this. Kangaroo walking meditation, demonstrated by Venerable Ananya. Your hand position like that, and you don't move left, right, all at the same time. One, two, three, go. One, two, three. Thank you so much. A round of applause. So, I expect every one of you here, unless you've got really bad legs, to do that at least once on this retreat. Especially if you see other people in the walking meditation rooms looking very miserable. From one end to the other, brings up joy and happiness. And that joy and happiness will increase your mindfulness. And increase other people's mindfulness as well. You become more alert, more awake. And it's also, you'll see deeper into what this meditation really is. And you become more still afterwards. This is not a joke. One of the reasons I wondered why Ajahn Chah was always laughing and saying funny things. It wasn't indulgence. There was something deeper in this. It was actually arousing more mindfulness, deeper mindfulness, seeing some of these obstacles in meditation and actually overcoming them. That's what mindfulness does. Stronger mindfulness, more happiness, more insight, more progress. That's how it works. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Please excuse me for rushing off a little bit of a shorter talk. For those who came a tiny bit late, you weren't really late. I was a bit early because I had to. Didn't miss very much. Actually, hardly anything at all. But I needed to get going to do all the other duties, which I have to do. I've got a choice. I haven't got a choice to do them or not to do them. To complain or enjoy it. I decide to enjoy it. Have a nice time. See you later. Ew. I did something wrong here. That's better. You're getting more. Thanks again, Analia, for doing that.